That was wonderful. Well, I am so grateful this morning for this opportunity. Thank you to Bob for the invitation. And thank you, Tom, for your support. Thanks, Pat, for your introduction. And thanks to John Michael, who really made the connection. He's much on my heart this morning and ours. So yes, mysticism and money, this opportunity to speak with you has given me a real chance to weave together these two streams that have been flowing through my life for decades. And in reviewing it all, I realized, my goodness, there has been a method to my madness, but it hasn't been my method. I want to just share a little bit about what I mean by mysticism. And there's a wonderful quotation from Jacob Burma, who is a 13th century mystic. And he saw that there is one heart, one being, one will, one God, all in all. And now, 7 centuries later, science has caught up with him. So we now know that we live in an interconnected universe. And mysticism has been a stream flowing really through all of our spiritual traditions. It's at the very headwaters of Christianity. And for me, it's about integrating within our being the human and the divine. So it's a path of transformation. And I don't call myself a mystic, but I'm someone who does try to walk on a mystical path. There's a beautiful quotation from, I can't say the name, it's an appendage to the Quran, and it goes like this: I was a hidden treasure, and I loved to be known. And what it speaks to is God's desire. What moved God to create the whole universe? And it speaks to this profound intimacy of God within the universe. I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known. So that's what I mean by mysticism. And you might wonder, so what could that possibly have to do with money? So what I'm going to share with you today about money is probably very different from other things you've heard about money. And I'm just going to dive in. I also want to express my gratitude to Willis Harmon. So Willis died in 98, but he was a true pioneer of consciousness, and he launched with Edgar Mitchell the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And sort of awkward. I want to see you, and if I put them like this, I can't see you. Willis launched the Institute of Noetic Sciences, studying consciousness, and so really a linking of spirituality and science. And he also, with Rinaldo Brutico, launched the World Business Academy, and we had such an amazing talk from Rinaldo a few weeks ago. And when I met Willis, he took time with me, and he really transmitted something to me of his view that business has the greatest responsibility, maybe of all of our institutions, because it's so powerful and it needs to be informed by spirituality. Through Willis, I met Bernard Lyotard. I met him in 1996 at a Soul of Money retreat. And Bernard has been a university professor in economics. He has been a central banker. He was one of the people who designed the ECU, which became the euro. So this fellow understands the monetary system better than probably anybody on the planet. And what he discovered at the central bank was he understood how money is structured, how money is created. And what he saw is that this systematic creation of money creates some of the problems that we exist in. The way it is structured, the way it is created, creates competition, creates scarcity, and I'll get into some of that as we go along. And when he went to the head of the central bank and said, you know, the way we're making money is creating some problems, they said, it's fine, we kind of like it the way it is. So he quit central banking and he started his life work of really speaking about currency and designing currencies that work more along the lines of an interconnected reality, that we are connected, there is no us and them, we're it. Cynthia, many of you probably know, she wrote The Wisdom Jesus and the Meaning of Mary Magdalene, the Holy Trinity. So she's been really leading this, I would say, resurrection of the wisdom tradition within Christianity. And I know many of you from her retreats, so I'm feeling terrific company here. So, these are pictures I took in my backyard. I had milkweed, and if you have milkweed, you'll have butterflies and get to watch this incredible miracle. So what I'm going to do for the next while is I'm going to weave some threads together or start some ingredients towards bread today. I'm just going to describe different ingredients and then mix them together into a good bread by the end of this. So just allow one piece and then the next and the next, and allow the images to speak to your heart. The mystical tradition really is a heart path, and sometimes our heads work too hard trying to figure it out, and if we open and allow our hearts to receive, it makes sense of things from another way of seeing wholeness. So, how does a caterpillar become a butterfly? Have you ever seen this? How a caterpillar actually becomes a chrysalis? It was the most extraordinary thing to watch. I wondered and wondered how they did it. And then it was amazing to see the form of the butterfly through the chrysalis. Now, biologists describe imaginal cells. So a biologist would say that there are disks, and they describe them very scientifically, how when the caterpillar becomes complete goop, there are little disks, little cells, that begin to form the butterfly, and they already exist within the caterpillar. And biologists call them imaginal cells. Cynthia also speaks of the imaginal realm as a realm that is, if we think of Russian dolls, you know, there's this doll and this doll and this doll, that we exist within a realm, an imaginal realm, that it already carries what we might call the implicate order. The great scientist David Bohm described it very well. So within the caterpillar is the implicate order of the butterfly. And as its goop, these imaginal cells begin to form the butterfly, first singly on their own. And the goop kind of fights against them, but they grow a little stronger and they keep going towards the butterfly, and they begin to resonate with each other and come together and connect. And eventually there's a tipping point and there is a butterfly. It's absolutely incredible. So the first thread I want us to think of today is imaginal cells. The second thread I want to weave, or ingredient I want to add, is some thinking from Teilhard de Chardin, who was I'm sure most of you know, both a physicist and a Jesuit, a priest. And he began to make some scientific discoveries and writings that the church wasn't too fond of, so they shipped him off to China, where, I love this picture because he's in China at this time. And because he was in China, he actually participated in the discovery of Peking Man. As a paleontologist, he was right on the edge of one of the greatest discoveries. And his mind as a physicist looked and looked and looked. And what he saw was that evolution, and he saw evolution with the mind of a priest. So there are two things that are very important about Teilhard to me this morning. And the first one is that he really heals a split between science and religion, which is wonderful. And he also really saw there is no split between spirit and matter, that they are two phases of one substance. So that's one thing. The other thing is, the way Teilhard saw evolution really affects where we can see where we are now. So I'll go through a little bit of that. First of all, he saw evolution as a rising tide of consciousness into higher and higher wholes. So he was seeing from, you know, eons, a very, very big seeing. And he saw that the more complexity, we're always going to more complexity, and when there's more complexity, there's also more consciousness. And he discerned that spirit is the power of synthesis and organization, organically and from within, which reminds me very much of the imaginal cells. That all along, the organic, intricate, implicate, intrinsic motion of rising to higher complexity and higher consciousness was there from the beginning when I was a hidden treasure. And I loved to be known. So Teilhard also saw these phase transitions. He saw that evolution didn't just go like this. He saw that it went along for a while and then there would be a leap. And the first leap that he described was from non-life to life, when the biosphere came into being. And I don't have any dates on this, what he talked about with that. But we can see that from the Big Bang, the elements interacted, and then there was a leap, and life began. And the next leap he described is from the biosphere to the noosphere. Again, there was a long waiting, and then there was a leap to the noosphere. And now we are on the brink, perhaps, we hope, of another leap. And he described it as a leap into the theosphere. And remember when Rinaldo was talking about us being at the point of a transition from Homo sapiens sapien to Homo universalis? Well, this is where we're at. And one of the things that Teilhard described so well, and it gives me huge hope, and that helps me see the world differently, and I hope that we can see the world this way more and more, that what he described is these phase transitions happen when there's great pressure. There has to be containment and great pressure. And the intensity grows, and the pressure, and in the goop of the chrysalis, there's the cells trying to make something happening. There's the pressure against it happening, but it's happening within a chrysalis, under tremendous pressure, and intensity and entanglement, that out of this comes the transition. And if anything could describe us now globally, we are contained as we've never been before. We have global communication. There isn't an eyeball on the planet that isn't watching Donald Trump. We have instantaneous communication, and this description of a butterfly wing over here affecting the other side of the world is true. We now know this profound interconnection, and we're in intense pain, and we're in intense struggle and pressure. But this shift to Homo Universalis, to theosphere, just thinking of that as a possibility transforms how I see the world. And putting that together with, I forgot some of my slides, but putting that together with imaginal cells, the link I want to make is that we are the imaginal cells. We have a role to play, to participate in this. So these are some of it, Teilhard's sketches, and you can see that he sees the growth into greater complexity. It's rising. His evolution isn't just random. It's purposive. It has a preferred axis. And he describes an omega point, which he called Christogenesis is cosmogenesis. So this implicate imaginal cell of Christ is within the process all along. Here's our container that's under a great deal of pressure. And as the pressure grows and the containment, the ripeness and fullness is all. And we may be giving birth to Homo Universalis. I believe we are. I had to include her as well. She plays a very important part in this. All right, so we have imaginal cells, and we have this tipping point on the globe, a phase transition that we're in the midst of. Those are two threads. The third thread I want to bring in is that, this is a book that Richard Rohr has just come out with, and it's another place where science has caught up with mysticism. And we now know that there aren't three separate substances of the Trinity, but that the Trinity describes a process of relationship, a flow of relationship. And Richard calls it a divine dance. And Cynthia describes it as the Father pouring into the Son, and the Son pouring into the Spirit, and the Spirit pouring. So there's this motion of giving and receiving, and giving and receiving, and the Trinity is this lovely community of relationship. A relationship that includes us. We're all familiar with the Rublev icon. Okay, I guess my time's up. But something I hadn't heard about it until preparing for this, and that is, do you see right underneath the wine, there's a little square in the tablecloth. And some scholars think there apparently was glue on the original icon in that square. And many think that there was actually a mirror there. And so when you looked at the icon, who is the fourth? We're it. We're it. And so the Trinity and this relationship, this giving and receiving, is an invitation for us to participate. It's a dance. Will you, won't you? Will you, won't you? Won't you join the dance? That's a fun line from Alice in Wonderland. Right. And the nature of this relationship is exchange, giving and receiving. And this is what science has discovered too. They were looking for atoms and quarks and pinning it down to a substance, and discovered it's the relationship between that is where everything is happening. It's the relationship. And this relationship is one of exchange. And here's how we might finally get to money. So, the root word of mercy and merchant and mercantile are the same. And this, I think, gives us a peek into the mercy of God, that we've tended to think of it as a one-way thing. But really, mercy is a divine exchange. It's a giving and receiving. And so commerce and mercantile could hold the very nature of God in this divine exchange. And this brings us to the next part about money. I'll let you read it. It's confusing if you read it and I read it at the same time. In no other culture or civilization that we know of has money been such a pervasive and decisive influence. In the world we now live in, money enters into everything human beings do, into every aspect and pocket of life. This is something new. And that's a quotation from Jacob Needleman. And God created money. Well, I think we have for many generations been completely unconscious about money and how it's created. And we just assume it just is, and like unconsciously think God created it the way it is. I'm very curious how many people here know how money is created. A few hands? Not very... Few? Yeah. Please don't feel bad that you don't know. It's been the biggest kept secret of all time, how money is created. David Rockefeller actually said, if people knew how money was created, there'd be a revolution tomorrow. Well, the revolution is actually happening. And one of the ways it's happening is you can now Google how money is created, and there are pages. And the IMF and the Bank of England and people from within those structures are speaking much more transparently about how money is created. I'm very, very, very glad that Stephen Dynan brought it up in his book, and that he has Bernard Lyotard in his 22nd chapter. I believe money is the lever of levers for shifting things. And what Stephen pointed to... Let's go to this one next. So money is a human agreement. By understanding how we hold money, we literally hold in our hands the power to change the world. To understand this simple fact is to take conscious control of where we want to go from here. So in chapter 22, Stephen hits some highlights about money. And the first one is that the Federal Reserve is not federal. that it is a private central bank owned by bankers. And yes, there's a very close relationship with government, but it is about as federal as Federal Express. There are no reserves. There is no money supply. And money is created out of thin air when banks make loans. So if you go to the bank and get a loan for $100,000 to buy a house, the bank simply makes a deposit via computer in your account, and that money, $100,000 is created that way. So money is really rooted in debt. And then they add an interest charge, which also has to be paid back. I want to say right now that I'm not trying to demonize money and banks. It's very, very important that we don't go there either, because the way money is created has, over the last centuries, expanded wealth throughout the planet. Enormous things have been created, cities. We've been to the moon. Our present monetary system is not all evil and bad, but it is something we have to understand and know about, because the way it's created structurally is creating some of our problems. And it gives us a great tool to begin to shift things in the direction we want to go. So money is created as debt with an interest charge. And here's a quotation from Bernard. We can produce more than enough food to feed everybody. And there's definitely enough work for everybody in the world. But there is clearly not enough money to pay for it all. The scarcity is in our national currencies. In fact, the job of central banks is to create and maintain that currency scarcity. The direct consequence is that we have to fight with each other in order to survive. So how did we get here with this monetary system? And there's a historical point that's very, very important, and that is that in 1668, the King of Sweden wanted to go to war with Denmark. And so the King of Sweden made a deal with the bank that became the Central Bank of Sweden. And the deal was the king gave the bank full monopoly over making money in exchange for the bank funding the war with Denmark. And then in 1694, England did the same thing. England, King William of Orange, I think, wanted to go to war, of course, with France. And the king went to the bank that became the Bank of England, which is still one of the most powerful entities in the world. And the same deal was made. The king gave the bank monopoly on money creation in exchange for the bank funding the war with France. We made a kind of similar arrangement in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve. Thank you for asking. What I'm going to do, the question was, where does gold fit into that? And what I'd like to do is, I'll make plenty of time for questions after we have coffee, just so I get through the more. So that's the kind of grim bit of this, but I really, again, want to say, we can't demonize this system. A lot has happened, but it's because it's so very out of balance. And now I'm going to have a great fun time sharing with you what I think was Bernard's real amazing work. In this book, New Money for a New World, he outlines the relationship of the feminine to money. And he was also a Jungian. He was very well versed in archetypes. And he discerned that a culture that revered the feminine tended to create money differently. So I'm going to have a real cook's tour through some history, and I think it'll really illuminate some things about money. Right, so from about 30,000 BC to about 9,000 BC, images like this proliferated. The Great Mother was worshipped and loved, and here's what Bernard writes. The intrinsic relationship between money and the Great Mother was self-evident to much of the ancient world. For tens of thousands of years, the Great Mother was the mythical connection to the mysteries of life and the most fundamental aspects of existence. Similarly, money represents abundance, generosity, sustenance, and at its deepest level, connected to our very survival. Substantial evidence demonstrates that not only was money invented during the extensive period when the Great Mother was honored, but that money's earliest forms were related to her. Some of them to share with you. Inanna, a Sumerian goddess. There was a carving over the storage of grain where she said, "Heaven is mine, earth is mine, I'm a wild cow." And head of cattle was associated with money. The more head of cattle you had, the more money you had. And capus was head of cattle. So our capitalism is even rooted in this sense of abundance. The other goddess represented here is Hathor from Egypt, whose udder was credited with creating the Milky Way. And she was another goddess of abundance and joy. And we all know Lakshmi, another goddess of abundance and joy. And the coin is from Rome a little bit later. It's from about 3000 BC, I think. Money was actually minted in the temple of a goddess, the goddess Juno Monita, where we get money. And on the other side of this coin was a cornucopia, symbolizing abundance. I can't remember the chapter. Stephen Dynan mentions masculine and feminine and the importance of balancing masculine and feminine. And Bernard speaks about currencies in terms of yin and yang. And I'll read the characteristics. We're all familiar with them. And these go beyond gender. They are dynamics or principles. Yin being cooperative, nurturing, intuitive, egalitarian trust and self-organization. Yang being more competitive, individualistic, analytical, and hierarchical authority. Once again, we need both. It's the dance between both that makes everything flow and work. So, from the time of fairly early on, the Stone Age began, I think, 8,000 BC. During the Stone Age, the shift from revering the feminine shifted more towards war and control over. And then we know that for many thousands of years, the feminine has been very, very repressed. It was repressed in all of the flourishing of the Greek civilization. Plato and everybody agreed that reason was it, and feminine was inferior. Our own Christian religion played a big part in repressing and denying the feminine, but there were two civilizations that didn't. And it's very, very interesting that dynastic Egypt, which was from about 3000 BC to 30 BC, for two millennia, this civilization absolutely flourished. And there were two characteristics that Bernard noted. One is They revered the feminine. The goddess Isis was very, very important. And it was a civilization that honored women. Many women were, there were apparently four pharaohs who were women. But the other characteristic is that besides having a centralized currency, there were many community currencies during this time. And these local currencies flowed throughout the communities. They were not centralized control. And they also were generated in local communities. They worked very well. For example, people who grew grain would come to the main storehouse, and they would deposit their grain and receive a pottery shard called nostraca. And on the pottery shard was marked how much grain they had deposited. And they received the ostraca, and they could use that to trade among themselves. And by this they knew two things. They knew, first of all, that there was something backing the money. This goes to your question of gold a little bit. They knew that there was grain in a storehouse to back the pottery shard. And they knew that they could go anytime to the storehouse and receive the grain back. But they would receive a little bit less grain than they had deposited because there is some attrition. But that meant instead of hoarding the shards and saving them up because they're going to grow, they spent them as fast as they could. And this created a tremendous circulation. Pottery shard would go around and around and around and around, create all kinds of commerce and exchanges and relationships. It sounds rather like the divine dance to me. So another civilization that flourished was during the Middle Ages, from about the middle of the 11th century to the end of the 13th. And this is the time in Europe when over 1,000 cathedrals were built. And they took time. They took a tremendous amount of energy to build. But all of these cathedrals were built, and they were all for Our Lady. And in the basement of many, underneath many of them, was the Black Madonna. So there was a revering of the feminine. It was a time of courtly love. And like in Egypt, it was a time of great flourishing with medicine and education and agriculture and commerce booming, a time of great flourishing. And they also had community currencies at that time. And again, they weren't saved up, but they were spent and circulated in the communities. And it was a time of great flourishing. So, again, there was the centralized currency for trade, and then there was the more localized currencies. And that's a balance of yin and yang, a balance of masculine and feminine. So in debt we trust. You know, again, I want to say it's a mechanism that has brought a lot, has spread a lot of wealth around the planet, but it is rooted in debt. And we are going to have to figure out something new about debt. If a bank in a town makes 10 loans of $100,000, $1 million of currency enters the community, and that needs to be paid back. But that money has been created, and it can be circulated, and it can be paid back. But there's an interest charge. And if the interest charge is 5%, for that $1 million that's been put in the community over, say, 20 years, that $1 million has to be paid back plus $750,000 of interest. So where does the interest come from? So this is how scarcity and a consciousness of scarcity and greed is rooted in our very monetary system. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I mean, it's just something for us to know and understand. There are ways that we can address this that are very encouraging. So, I've mentioned alternative currencies and community currencies, and the good news is that even though they're not making headlines, they actually did make Forbes magazine. there are currencies flourishing around the world and growing and taking root, and so it's like imaginal cells. They're still kind of happening individually, but they are growing and they are connecting, and I'll just introduce you to a few of them. The Brixton Pound, a community-generated currency. It supports local businesses, and the city council is now accepting some taxes being paid in the Bristol Pound. That's in England. In Japan, there's this wonderful system called Furea Kipu, and 478 Furea Kipu systems are operating. And the way they operate is, if you take your neighbor, who's elderly, to the store for groceries, you earn a Furea Kipu, and it goes into the system. If you help sweep the whatever needs to be done, take them to the doctor, bring them their medicine, whatever care needs to be done, you earn a Furea Kipu. And you can use that later in your life when you need care, or you can send it to your elderly mother in another city, and she has Furea Kipu to hire someone to come and help her. This has helped Japan keep many of their elderly in home and in relationship. So time banks are also flourishing, and it's a system, well, hopefully it's becoming more systematic. Again, it's like the imaginal cells, little parts growing here and there, but connecting and getting stronger. Time banks have you can sign up online and describe what gift you have to give and also what need you have, and then people can meet and exchange time. The Vere Bank is one of the oldest of the alternative solutions, and in Switzerland, over 60,000 businesses participate in the Vere Bank, and it's a mutual credit system. They extend each other credit, and small and medium-sized businesses flourish. In the Bay Area, there's Bay Bucks. And these are the missions that we had in Santa Barbara. I was part of this experiment. We, for 6 months, ran this experiment with these beautiful clay coins that we made. I have some here. We made them of clay, and we fired them in a kiln, and we gave them to a food independence co-op, and the co-op paid people to come and work in gardens, and the gardens were like Trinity Lutheran's garden that supplies Sarah House and Casa Esperanza. So we participated in the food system and augmented it. And we did, we had bigger plans, but as an imaginal cell, you also need to be paid. So it's an experiment that we're hoping to pick up again when there's some more energy and support for these kinds of experiments. Stephen Dynan mentioned Ellen Brown, and Ellen is amazing, her understanding of the monetary system. But she has started the Public Banking Institute. And I'm so glad Stephen mentioned that. Because to make a loan to create money could be a very good mechanism. But if that interest went back to the state, for example, as in North Dakota, where there is a state bank, then there's a huge benefit spread around. So public banking is growing. Apparently 21 states, including California, it's on 21 state legislatures to create state banks. And she lives in Santa Monica and ran for Treasury of the State of California. Wasn't elected, but maybe next time she will be. These are her two books. Okay, so no talk about money is complete without mentioning blockchain or Bitcoin. So Bitcoin and Ethereum made a whole bunch of news. They grew very big, and then they kind of collapsed, and then they grew again. One description of it, the most disruptive technology since the internet. An entirely new way of holding and exchanging assets, including money. So I can't explain blockchain to you, you know. It's like, how does it work on the computer that these decentralized units come into being? But this is a wonderful image of decentralized, self-organizing creation of currency that is transparent. And one of the great things about blockchain is it can't be fiddled with. It can't be... It's once it's done, it's done. You can't fiddle the books. So it holds tremendous potential and promise for being a currency that connects and circulates on the planet. Keep your eyes on it. It's pretty, pretty exciting. That means a revolution is coming, a fundamental sea change in the way we do business. And just wrapping up, other systemic changes that I wanted to mention, and if you go to thenextsystem.org, there'll be more information. Worker-owned cooperatives. There are now 10, I believe it's billion? No, that wouldn't be right. There are 10 million currently in worker-owned cooperatives in the U.S. Again, it doesn't make the headlines. But this is a transformation of capitalism where the workers are owning the cooperatives. They've figured out great ways to do business. And it's just wonderful to read about. So worker-owned cooperatives are taking form, as is public banking, and also community land trusts. So these are very transformational systems that are emerging as imaginal cells within America now. And if we know about them, we can be more supportive of them. The final one I want to mention is Jenny Kasson, who I'm actually working with on our books, to raise money. And she's transforming the investment relationship and the whole... from venture capitalists who want to, who make a big investment, and they certainly want a return, but from a Wall Street mentality to a relationship mentality. She's training women who are creating mission-driven businesses how to raise money in a very good relationship with their investors. So it's another transforming piece that's happening in our monetary system. And that's tonight at Weave. Thank you for noticing. She's speaking tonight at Women's Economic Ventures. Oh, just on time. Wow. Phew. So I want to leave us with this question. How do we participate as imaginal selves? at this time of global shift, as cosmogenesis that can be Christogenesis. I'm sure there's so much wisdom in this room about this, and let's have coffee and take up this question after coffee. Thank you so much.